Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On October 1st, 1992, Texas businessman Ross Perot announced in a news conference that he would run for president as an independent because neither Republicans nor Democrats had addressed the major problems facing the country.
Now to the American people, I don't belong to anybody but you. You, the people, own me. If you elect me, I go as your servant. I will work night and day to see that the priorities that you have established are accomplished.
Perot did not win, but 19 million American voters cast their ballot that year for the Texas billionaire in one of the best showings by a third-party candidate of an independent in the previous century. We're talking about the impact of third-party candidates and why they still matter today. Paul Beck is an OSU professor emeritus and political scientist. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Barbara Peary is the Gerald L. Belisle's Professor and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Ann.
Barbara Peary, why did the political landscape develop into largely a two-party system in the United States?
Well, that's an easy one. As Paul and I are political scientists, we learned this in PS 101,
right,
or American Government 101. And that's because, we started out as a country with, as it turned out, a tradition of two parties. I would say that the founders were scared of political parties. They're not mentioned in the Constitution, but they walk out of Constitution Hall in Philadelphia, and what do? They divide into two parties based on whether they were for the new Constitution or against it, so the so-called Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And it just has developed that way as a tradition and a culture. And then we have these mechanical or systemic issues. We don't have a proportional representation system as many parliamentary countries do because we have a presidential system. It's so-called winner take all. You know, you just either win it or you don't. And if you win a certain percentage, you don't get a certain percentage of seats in the Congress. And then it's hard to get on a ballot sometimes if you're a third party candidate. You might have to get a certain number of signatures. And then if we think of presidential debates, you know, you started with Perot. He did come up to the level where he was able to get onto the debate stage. But most of the time, it's hard to meet the threshold to get on the debate stage. So we end up again with a Democrat and a Republican there on the stage for debate.
So, Paul Beck, they didn't ban outside parties. They just made it hard for more than two parties to operate in the country?
Well, when you refer to they, of course,
they,
the framers of the Constitution,
yeah,
didn't really think about parties.
Okay.
And parties didn't develop until the early 1800s, in fact, as parties, which meant that they had a reach to the grassroots level. But our rules really mitigate against the development of third parties. There have been periods in our history, particularly post-Civil War, where third parties did fairly well. And we need to remember that the Republican Party, when it was founded, was a third party. It very quickly displaced the Whigs and became the second party in the system, and the Whigs die off. But the rules are very powerful here. We have, as Barbara put it, elections that are first past the post, which means if you come in first, you win. You don't have to win a majority. You win. And so that makes it unlikely that voters are going to want to cast a ballot for somebody who is going to be a loser. So voters are pushed to vote strategically in a way by deciding among one of the two leading candidates. And then if you think about politicians, if you or I wanted to run for office, particularly with the advent of primary elections, we have a much better chance of being a major party nominee and winning the election than we have as running as an independent. Now, Perot is an exception to that. But if you go back to 2016, you have two really good examples of that. Bernie Sanders, never a Democrat, runs in the Democratic primary and does really quite well. Donald Trump, probably never really a Republican, maybe never a Democrat either, runs in the Republican primary and does very well. So the possibility of winning a nomination of a major party is a big, big prize for candidates. And that mitigates against the development of third parties or independent candidacies. What we see more, and Perot, again, is a good example, is Perot ran as an independent the first time in 1992. And then he runs as the Reform Party candidate in 1996. But running as an independent with almost, I think it was over $60 million he was able to put into the campaign in an era where television really matters. he was able to sustain a viable candidacy, though he didn't come in first in any state. So he doesn't win the election. And in fact, the interesting thing about Perot is before he dropped out of the race in June, and then he got back in later mm-hmm. on, but before he dropped out of the race in June, the polls showed that he was likely to come in second, maybe even first. And as voters thought about him after he came back in, they said, well, this guy really can't win. So even though I may prefer him to either of the major party candidates, Clinton and Bush, I'm going to go ahead and vote for one of those two.
A lot of psychology there. We are talking about the impact of third-party candidates and why they still matter, even though they usually don't win. That's Paul Beck. He's professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State University. Also with us, Barbara Perry. She's director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. If you have a question or comment coming up this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Barbara Perry, I'm wondering about the Fourth Estate now. You know, other parties, the Libertarian and Green parties, they hold conventions, but they're rarely covered by the mainstream media, by the Fourth Estate. How much of a role does the media play in modern politics, I suppose, but maybe going back farther in the enduring strength of the two-party system?
Well, media obviously always play a role. I mean, we could come up to the president and say, I suppose the good news for either third parties or parties that aren't in the mainstream of the two major parties, social media can be a godsend. Just as Paul pointed out, that Perot was able to dump a lot of money into media coverage and go on media at that time, you know, television, CNN. We thought, okay, well, he's got a lot of power. But think of the power of social media now. But certainly through our traditional media coverage, you're right that it's hard for these third parties to get coverage. Another thing that we haven't mentioned yet, actually two more things. One is the systematic and systemic issues of primaries in terms of how you get to vote in a primary. I don't know whether Ohio is a so-called closed primary state. I grew up in Kentucky, and it is a closed primary state. So first of all, when you register to vote, you have to register either in one of the two parties. You can register with a third party or fourth party, or you can register as an independent. But then in order to vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary, you have to be registered in that party. Now, I'm now in Virginia, which is an open primary state. We don't register by party at all. And you can go and vote if you wish in the Republican primary, vote in the Democratic party. They don't ask you what party you affiliate with. But if you're in a closed primary state, again, that works to the benefit of the major parties. And then the other element that we didn't talk about for Ross Perot, but to add to Paul's excellent historical representation of it, is that what tends to happen is that because we have this two-party tradition and the system supports that, if one of the two major parties sees that a third-party candidate or someone who's not in the main parties, like a Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. notice how some members now who are trying to get the Democratic nomination are shifting over to the Bernie Sanders positions on health care, for example. Or in the case of Perot, the major parties, particularly the Democrats, led by Bill Clinton, the so-called third way candidate, the moderate candidate, they took on the main issue of Ross Perot, which was a balanced budget. And so that often happens, that our big tent two parties see that somebody's getting a lot of traction as a third party or an independent, and they say, wow, we better get on that bandwagon. And indeed, Ross Perot got 19% of the popular vote in 1992. So guess what? We balance the budget.
Right. They direct attention to certain issues if they can get enough traction among the electorate. And that's the big gift. And Ross Perot, of course, famously spent $60 million of his own money on it. The money alone now to run at the beginning of the Republic, that wasn't as much of an issue. Candidates didn't travel around. Now we have television. Now we have travel. They expect the candidates to show up in Iowa. It's a huge country to run a winner-take-all kind of a campaign, isn't it right, Barbara Perry?
Well, it is. And now we haven't added in the winner-take-all element of the Electoral College. So while Ross Perot got 19% of the popular vote, he didn't win one electoral vote because right. he didn't win the majority vote in any of the 50 states. So again, makes it that much harder. You did mention media and going back into history. Mm-hmm. You know, people think the media are biased and, oh, you know, newspapers are liberal or Democrat. Well, in the founding period, once once these factions got going, as Paul said, they might not have been parties as we recognize them today formalistically, but certainly the newspapers were much more biased than they are now, in the sense that there were Republican newspapers, or there were Democratic newspapers, or there were Federalist newspapers at the beginning, or anti-Federalist newspapers. So in many ways, before the kind of professionalization of the media in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was just absolute bias, and everybody knew what the bias was in the main source of media in those days, which would have been newspapers.
Let's see. I want to do a follow-up. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John. Hello, John.
Just now. Hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay. You mentioned the Electoral College just a minute ago, and my theory is that that's the one thing that makes us different from every other democracy, and it does, I think, reinforce the two-party system. What do you think about my idea?
Yeah, Paul.
I think, John, you're right on both counts. It is a mechanism that nobody else really has. And then you realize with the Electoral College, to win the electoral votes of, let's say, a state like Ohio, all you have to do is come in first. You don't have to get a majority.
But that's different between the – not all the states are the same.
Well, almost all the states are the same. There are two exceptions, but they're minor exceptions.
Okay.
And so you can win. In fact, Trump in 2016 and Hillary Clinton in 2016 won a number of states in terms of Electoral College votes where they did not get a majority of votes. And so there's really kind of a disincentive built in for third-party candidates and for voting for third-party candidates under those particular rules. So the Electoral College, I think, plays a role. It's one of a number of things that play a role, but it's another set of rules in a way, or institutional mechanisms that favor two parties.
Thank you, John, for that call. Everybody else, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Barbara Peary, are there any common themes that behind third-party candidacies that get any kind of traction? What propels them to do it? Say a George Wallace or a Ross Perot.
Sure.
Or, yeah.
Sure. So I would say in some ways, I'm looking back at a chart that was in a UVA publication called UVA Today back in 2016. I did an interview with them, and they did a really good chart on the main third-party candidates, starting with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, Robert La Follette, 1924, Strom Thurmond, 48, George Wallace, you mentioned, 68, and, of course, Ross Perot, 92, sort of the main ones in the presidential area. And now that you say, is there a theme, I would say in some ways Ross Perot's a bit of an outlier in that that balanced budget concept, while it might be viewed as radical in Washington that's used to dealing with unbalanced budgets, I think it was viewed as rather moderate by people. Like, doesn't that make sense to have a balanced budget? So I would say by personality, Ross Perot was extreme, but his one major topic, he was kind of a one-issue candidate, a balanced budget, did not seem extreme, at least to me. But if you look at, certainly, I would say Theodore Roosevelt, La Follette, and particularly Strom Thurmond and George Wallace, they're more on the extreme side. And so, again, that's where the parties will look at that and say, ooh, maybe we better gather some of those people in because they're getting some votes. Strom Thurmond, George Wallace, segregationists, white segregationists from the South, they break off from the Democratic Party, they're extremists. La Follette and Theodore Roosevelt on the left side, we would probably say now in the progressive movement. And so I would say that there's that theme of being to one extreme or the other. And America, to my view, in a good way, has tended to be more moderate. So they always say to win your presidential primary, you might have to run to the extreme left or right. But then to win the electorate in the general election, you have to be more moderate, run to the center. As someone who's a moderate, I actually like that idea.
That's Barbara Peary. She is the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center. Also with us, Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State. We're talking about third-party candidates today, and not just for the highest office in the land, but at every level. In Athens and Southern Ohio, three independent socialists were on the November ballot. We'll talk to one of them later on in the program. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Over the summer of 1992, Texas billionaire Ross Perot vowed that he would not run for president. 11 weeks later, on October 1st, Perot announced that volunteers across the country, especially the young people, had persuaded him to change course.
To the many young people, and it's a disproportionate number of very young people who have called me, written me, and some have even driven across country to Dallas to visit with me at their own expense, expressing concern about what kind of country they will live in as adults, wondering whether or not they will even have a job when they get out of school.
Perot was one in a long line of independent candidates to seek elective office, and support by young people often is a factor in the calculation to run. We're talking about third-party candidacies today, not just for the highest office in the land, but at every level. We're going to be talking to one of the three independent socialists on the November ballot in Athens County later in the program. Still with us is Ohio State political scientist emeritus Paul Beck, and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia, Barbara Perry. Joining us is Professor of History and Law at Ohio State, David Stebbin. David, let's talk about the appeal of third parties or among younger voters. Neither Perot and certainly not Bernie Sanders could have considered themselves young blood, but they attract the attention of young voters. How does that work?
Well, young voters are often interested in new ideas and dissatisfied with the status quo in some way, and that was certainly true for Ross Perot. Professor Perry rightly talked about the balanced budget, and to a lot of newer voters, that would seem like a sensible thing to do. And the other issue that he really spoke to that many of them were concerned with was sort of the loss of good jobs for those without a lot of skills, formal education. So he had this famous phrase from the early the giant sucking sound you hear is jobs going abroad and so on. And there's an interesting Ohio connection here in the sense that he got 21% of the vote in Ohio, which are a lot of votes, even though he never made a campaign appearance in Ohio in 1992. But he showed up in Ohio in, I believe, the fall of 94 to campaign against NAFTA and had a big rally at the convention center downtown. And I attended just as an observer, because, and it was fascinating. Country and Western bands, really song sheets, really, and a lot of young folks as well as older folks. It's an unusually varied crowd, almost entirely white, right? But the trade and immigration issues, and the two of them are linked, definitely things that he cared about. And the young people who were there were more it's not that exactly that they were anti-foreigner. They were concerned about middle-class jobs for the next generation, and rightly so, to be concerned about that, what jobs that paid well. And so sometimes older people can communicate with the young. And in the case of Ross Perot, he could remember an earlier America where there were higher barriers to trade and immigration. He's sort of an Eisenhower-era guy, and much of what he was describing is that era. Which faded, and there are some younger people who like aspects of that time.
Did he tap into, Barbara Perry, you think, the same thing that Donald Trump did with kind of an outsider status? Nobody thought he was going to get the Republican nomination, but also that Make America Great Again theme.
I do, Ann. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I've often thought in this Trump era that there are harkenings back to Ross Perot, and I'm glad that David added to the balanced budget concept the anti-free trade approach of Ross Perot, which was against NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, which Republicans had typically been for, you know, free trade, and the Democrats, again, with Bill Clinton leading the way in this kind of third way approach, a more moderate approach that jumped on the bandwagon of NAFTA. And I think I'm remembering correctly that on the old Larry King talk show that mm-hmm. was prime time on CNN for years, that Ross Perot went on with Al Gore, the vice presidential candidate, or maybe by that time he'd even won, to debate NAFTA. And, you know, Al Gore had many drawbacks as a personable candidate, but he was really good at wonky details. And so he defended NAFTA in a very positive way. But we see the blowback against that, I guess, in addition to the sucking sound, now there's been this giant blowback sound. And that's in part what carried Trump into office. In addition, we haven't mentioned for Perot that he was famous for attempting to get back American military prisoners of war missing in action in Vietnam. And that appealed to middle America and patriotism and support for the military.
You know, I would add, coming back to the question about the youth vote, first, Trump did not do well among young people.
Yeah.
So he was not like Perot and some other independents. The other thing about them is that they tend to be less wedded to the two major parties, certainly entering the electorate at age 18 and going into their 20s. They are less likely to be Democrats or Republicans, more likely these days to be Democrats than Republicans. But still, a lot of them will profess and self-identify as independents, which means they're available for a third party or an independent candidate. And as David put it, and I think it's correct, there's also the attractiveness of something new. Somebody who is not one of those old two parties and one of the nominees from them. And so young people are attracted to that. That was the attraction that Bernie Sanders had, even though he was running in Democratic primaries.
You know, Perot also wasn't afraid to try something new. I remember how they produced a big screen closed circuit news conference for his announcements to sites across the country, including in Columbus. And I was there at that event, and I think it was at the fairgrounds. I can't quite remember. He's also known for how he tapped cable television, right, which was still new. And one scholar said that he laid the foundation for cable-era politics and thinking of new ways to reach voters. And to wit, I got these cuts of Perot from C-SPAN, which back in then it was still very, very new, almost quaint. Barbara Peary, again, we're kind of feel – it feels like we're sort of talking about two different things. We're talking about – independence more than we are third parties like the Green Party and the Communist Party or the Socialist Party or anything like that. It seems more like we're talking about outsiders. Is that right?
Well, again, if you look back to these five or so candidates who made the biggest impact, at least in presidential races, as we pointed out, Ross Perot, at the first time he ran, was as an independent and didn't want to identify with the party. George Wallace's party was called American Independent Party. So they do try to tap into, create, surround themselves with some apparatus of a party. Strom Thurmond, in breaking off from the Democratic Party before he became a Republican, we should add, but, you know, famously walked out, or infamously walked out of the 1948 Democratic Convention when they adopted a civil rights plank and formed the so-called Dixiecrat Party. Robert La Follette ran on a progressive party ticket. And then Teddy Roosevelt, we know, had been a Republican, had come in as vice president upon the assassination of William McKinley in 1901, ran in his own right as a Republican, put his selected protege, William Howard Taft, into the driver's seat for the Republican nomination. Taft went on to be president for one term, but was not progressive enough for Theodore Roosevelt. So he bolted from the Republicans in 1912 and formed his own third party, Bull Moose. So we've got two patterns or two models here. The Perot, at least the first time he ran, to just run as an independent. But again, most people see the benefit of trying to surround themselves with the party. And as Paul said back at the top of the hour, the beginning of the show, that's the way the Republican Party began, as a third party, an anti-slavery party in the mid-1850s, and then, of course, by the Lincoln election in 1860 became one of the two major parties which we have to this day.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about that third candidate on the ballot. It's mostly gets our attention when it happens during a presidential election cycle, but it's happening all the time at local levels across the country. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David Stebbin, what sort of movements have emerged over the course of the Republic to counter the strength of the two-party system? Have there ever been anything? We know people often talk about the Electoral College, to abolish the Electoral College. Is that much of a movement, or are there others?
Well, there are times when dissatisfaction with the Electoral College goes up. There are times when it goes down. If there are misfires, then that makes people angry. But the two-party system in the modern early decades of the 19th century sense has really become central to the workings of the American political system. The Democratic Party was founded in the 1820s, in part because barriers to suffrage for white men went way down. So the electorate got a lot bigger, and you needed some institution to organize mass numbers of votes. So Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren formed the Democrats, and then the Whigs emerged in the 1830s as a rival party. And the habit in the 19th century for white men, the enthusiasm for party politics was not purely political. They almost had the quality of major sports franchises later on in the Republic. In other words, they were social institutions, and you were partisan and you rooted for your side and so on. So they become so deeply ingrained in the fabric of the system. It's hard to imagine the two major parties going away or one of them being replaced by a third party now. So the modern era of third parties and independents has tended to be one in which the two major parties are avoiding some issue or set of issues that voters care a lot about. And then these other movements arise. And sometimes it's within parties. So Professor Perry talked about people like Strom Thurmond and George Wallace, and they were lifelong Democrats. And their faction of the party lost out in some way, and they became alienated, so they ran as independents. And Theodore Roosevelt fits that model, as does John Anderson, who ran for president in 1980. He was the liberal Republican who ran as an independent in that election because his wing of the party lost out to the Ronald Reagan-dominated wing. And so the two parties are essentially acting as a duopoly on some set of issues, not responding to what voters want in terms of change. So then you have these dissident movements. And the history of the Republic is basically, since the two major parties emerged, the ones we have now, is the parties eventually adapt at least some of those issues, mm-hmm. co-opt them, if you want to put it that way, or absorb some of that
energy. At least the candidates do to one extent or another.
Right, but yeah. Even the party platforms generally respond. And by the way, the other thing that's changed, and this has been mentioned by both of the other guests earlier, is in the modern media age, the need for large sums of money for television in particular and screens in general has become so pronounced that it's become structurally harder to organize a truly competitive, can actually win third party. And so the self-financed candidate has, since Ross Perot, has become the new model of making a real difference if you're an independent candidate for president, for example, or at the gubernatorial level, which occasionally happens. And there aren't very many of those, right? In other words, people were concerned, the Democrats were concerned about Howard Schultz, for example, the Starbucks CEO running as an independent, mm-hmm. because their surveys indicated, the polls that the Democrats did, that he would take more votes away from any Democratic candidate than from Donald Trump. And he is wealthy enough that he could have mounted a credible challenge. He ultimately decided not to run. But there are other people out there. Former Mayor Bloomberg, Mike Bloomberg of New York City, right. would be another. And what these people do, Schultz and Bloomberg, is they look at polls and they figure they're just going to help the incumbent win again, which is not the thing they want to do because of this first-past-the-post system. So there are a lot of different factors that discourage the emergence of a third party that can actually win, but they still play a valuable role.
Questions still linger about whether Perot helped Clinton get elected in 1992 and whether Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate in 2000, did the same for George W. Bush. They're called spoilers. Barbara Peary, is there any evidence that it would have gone another way or could have gone another way?
Yes, and I'm so glad that you brought that up. I was just anxious to jump in and say if one wants to vote for an independent or a third party or a fourth party or fifth party candidate, that person always has to ask, given the system that we have, are you willing to accept that your third party vote may help someone win with whom you utterly disagree? So we've already pointed out the possibilities of a third party or a run that would take away Democratic votes. And if people don't like Trump, it would help him be reelected. But I think you're absolutely right that the votes that went to Ralph Nader in Florida in 2000 lost Florida for Al Gore, since the final tally seemed to indicate that George Bush won Florida by maybe 300 or at the most 500 votes. And Ralph Nader certainly had more than that. And I will just give a state example from yesterday from my native state of Kentucky. Right now, it looks like Beshear has about a 0.4% lead over the incumbent Bevin. I noted that the Libertarian got 2% of the vote. So let's say that Libertarian votes might have gone to a more conservative incumbent Bevin, would have put him past Beshear.
Yeah. But anything. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Paul Beck.
I think that's probably right. That Bevin must be really irritated that there was this Libertarian candidate on the ballot. And it could happen. I mean, there was an argument back in 2016 that the presence of Jill Stein on the ballot as a third-party candidate probably cost Hillary Clinton Michigan, maybe even Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. It's not provable.
Right.
You don't know that these voters for a third-party candidate would have stayed in the electorate and voted for one of the two major party candidates, but it is plausible, just as it is plausible that Perot cost Bush re-election in 1992.
And actually, if I could weigh in on this, the one other thing that's changed is the decision to let third-party candidates, if they poll high enough, into the debates. And in 1992, in that first presidential debate, and the first one often matters the most because first impressions are lasting, George Bush Sr. was actually doing a very good job of putting Bill Clinton on the defensive. And then I saw something I had never seen before, and I've seen every presidential debate. Some of them I wasn't old enough. I had to go back and watch the
okay,
film, but I've seen them all,
right,
as an adult. What had I never seen before? A third person came in and assisted, in other words, went after George Bush Sr. in a very credible way that Bill Clinton couldn't. And ultimately, that hurt Bush and helped Clinton. And so third-party candidates can also matter now in debates if they get into them.
And likewise, Ross Perot's running mate was a debacle on the debate stage.
Correct. Right. Admiral Stockdale.
Right.
The typical response, they surveyed voters, he's obviously a very nice man, but he was not ready to do that.
Barbara Peary, before I let you go, I wanted to bring up one more issue. George Wallace ran as an independent for president in 1968. He won more than 13% of the vote running against Republican Richard Nixon, Democrat Hubert Humphrey. His candidacy was known for its backlash politics and for bringing that out and bringing it to the fore. It feels like backlash politics has never left us since then.
Well, I'm just thinking, did it start then? And I would have to say no, because I would go to Strom Thurmond in 1948 as backlash and really the precursor of George Wallace, as the South, the solid Democratic South, because of the way the civil rights movement moved forward, because of the Voting Rights Act of 65, the 64 Civil Rights Act, that we saw the turn then to the solid Republican South, which we tend to see today, except for my current state of Virginia. So I would say that backlash phenomenon on that subject alone, on race and civil rights, you can certainly, in this conversation today about third parties, you can trace to Strom Thurmond. But I guess I would argue on the other side of that coin, on race, again, the Republican Party coming on the scene is a backlash against the pro-slavery party of the Democrats leading up to the Civil War.
Cuts both ways. Well, Barbara Peary, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed being on with my colleagues as well.
Barbara Peery is the Gerald L. Baliles Professor and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center. We will get back with you. We're talking about third-party candidacies, whether it's an independent, a Green Party, Socialist Party, you name it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to hear from a third-party candidate out of Athens County who's on the ballot yesterday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about third-party candidates today, and not just for the highest office in the land, but at every level. In Athens County in southern Ohio, three independent socialists were on the November ballot. Still with us is Ohio State political scientist emeritus Paul Beck, also professor of history and law at Ohio State, David Stebbin. Independent socialist McCray Powell took about 7% of the vote yesterday in his bid for a seat on the Nelsonville City Council. Welcome to the show, McCray Powell.
Hi, everyone. It's great to talk to you guys.
Why did you decide to run as a third-party candidate?
Well, Nelsonville is actually a nonpartisan race, mm-hmm. so all of us would be independent candidates in that race, which I was very thankful for because I would never run as a Democrat or a Republican.
Why not?
I do not believe that the main parties represent the interests of the working class. They instead represent the interests of the owner class, and I tried to run to represent the interests of the working class, which is what I am.
What's it like when you're – is this your first run for public office?
It is, yes.
So you don't really have anything to compare it to, but what was your sense? How did it feel to be running from the outside of the system, knowing, obviously, it's nonpartisan, but, you know.
I mean, really the highlights of it was going door-to-door all over town and just talking to residents about – what's going on in their lives. Most of the people had never had anyone knock on their door to ask questions like that. They don't feel represented by city government or state government or federal government at all. These people in Appalachia feel completely alienated from the system. And I think for good reason, these people know that no one is coming to save them and that everyone who has ever come into this area has just taken advantage of them and abandoned them.
How much was a part of what you did just trying to turn out the vote? Because there's also, when people feel that way about the system, they tend to not even register, let alone show up at the ballot box.
You know, that certainly was a challenge for sure. A lot of people had said to me at the door, why should I vote? It's never helped me before. And I really can't argue against that. It really hasn't helped them before. Things in this area have gotten worse. We have people on council, been on council for over 20 years, that have nothing to show for it whatsoever. We did register a lot of people to vote. I know we had a lot of first-time voters this year who did vote for me, and I am quite proud about that.
Yeah, 7%, not bad for a first time out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any pushback about your identification as, I want to make sure I get it right, independent socialist?
Yeah, I ran as a revolutionary socialist, and I was very open about that the entire campaign, as was Ellie Hamrick, who ran in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I didn't get any pushback at all till about 2 weeks before the election. And that's when the smears started, and I thought that was quite funny because they were really fixated on old newspaper articles from months ago. I guess they don't read the papers. But there was quite a backlash against me and other candidates in town, talking about us being these scary communists and whatnot when we're fighting for a stronger housing code, you know, and higher wages.
Paul Beck? Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, I said we were just fighting for a stronger housing code mm-hmm. and higher wages.
I wanted to talk about the socialist, identification in today's politics. What kind of value does it have? What kind of what are the assets? What are the deficits of being identified in any way as a socialist or a communist, but mostly socialist? I mean, that's what we see.
Well, we may see in 2020, the Republicans, it looks like, are gearing up to attack the Democratic nominee for president. as a socialist, whoever that nominee will
be.
And we'll see how much that resonates with the public. My sense is that it's not the negative term that it used to be. And they even sometimes grade into calling them communists, which I think is not the negative term that it used to be. Certainly for younger generations, those terms may not have really very much meaning.
Yeah. David Stubbin?
Well, and one factor here is that there were socialists, for example, in Congress until World War I, until the Bolshevik Revolution,
right,
essentially. And then so during the Cold War period, it was very hard to be labeled that. Professor Perry did not mention there was a fourth party in 1948, Henry Wallace's Progressive Citizens of America, and he had Communist Party backing, even though he was not a communist. But that faded. The ability to be openly labeled a socialist or a communist and win high public office disappeared for a while. But if you were born in the early 1990s, after the wall came down and the government in Russia changed and so on, you've grown up in an era where the Cold War way of thinking is not so salient. And if you grew up in the recent decades, income and wealth inequality has become so much more pronounced that what socialist candidates talk about seems more relevant to regular folks' lives again. And so once again, as before World War I, we have socialists in Congress. Not many, but a few.
Does that sound familiar, McCrae Powell? I mean, is that sort of the sort of thing you were able to convey in your campaigning?
Yeah, absolutely. Athens County is one of the most unequal counties in Ohio. This is incredibly poor here. And this region, people know the bourgeoisie by name. They know who these people are. It's a very small town, and they do absolutely hate them. And so it's easy to talk to people about these issues and then take them away from, like, more family analysis of it to more systematic analysis of it. We definitely have a few more people much more interested in socialism in this town than we did before we started these campaigns.
I'm going to turn to Mark in Columbus. You're on the air, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So often the third party or independent access is restricted, limited, marginalized. If one wanted to break the stranglehold of a two-party system over the election, something very simple and practical to me would seem the idea. Right now, each county has four board of election members. Two are Democrat and two are Republican. However arbitrary that is, they have a monopoly. If a fifth position were opened up on each county board of elections, and that would be for independent and or third party candidate, that might tremendously open up ballot access for individuals in referendums and things. Where right now, the county board of elections tend to vote in block with arbitrary interpretations of the laws to deny access to third party independents and referendum initiatives. That might open it up.
Yeah, that's interesting. McCrae Powell, any sense about your experience with the Athens County Board of Elections?
I have a lot of experience with the Athens County Board of Elections, actually. One of my first feats of organizing was trying to keep our polling places open here in Nelsonville. The Athens County Board of Elections tried to close down four places and make it just one polling location. That was an unsafe walk and very inaccessible for handicapped individuals. We won that fight. Our polling places stayed open, and we thankfully had all our polling places for this last election. I was quite worried the Board of Elections might be more scrutinizing of our signatures and whatnot because we did have a whole campaign against them not long before this election.
Hmm. And the idea of having a fifth wheel in power there?
I certainly think that would be something to explore. I think the issue is just having Democrats and Republicans at all. Having another voice in there would certainly help, but that's not going to solve the overall problem.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to get to, let's see, Elizabeth in Cincinnati. You're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I believe that the Ohio Constitution gives a lot of preferential treatment to Democrats and Republicans in terms of getting on the ballot.
Okay.
The number of signatures is overwhelmingly in their favor. To run as an independent, you need something like 10 times as many independent signatures to get on the ballot, and how that affects who's able to run in the first place.
Paul Beck?
Yeah, it turns out that the major party candidates or nominees qualify for the ballot automatically. Whereas independents have to earn their way on, or even nominees of third parties that have not done well in the past qualify just to be on the ballot itself, have to get a certain number of signatures. It will come as no surprise to anyone that the two major parties conspire together, I guess would be the way to put it, to try to restrict access to the ballot to third-party candidates and independent candidates. Having said that, however, the kinds of barriers that they've been able to erect are less today than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. I'm reminded of the John Anderson candidacy back in 1980, where Anderson had to spend all of the campaign money that he had raised just to get on the ballot. And I think he made it for all 50 states, maybe not quite all 50 of them. But he had nothing left over to run a campaign for the general election. It's easier today for people to get on the ballot as an independent or a third party candidate, though it still is not always easy.
And it varies between the states.
Oh, it varies enormously. There was just an article the other day in the paper that New York State is considering increasing the number of signatures that would be required for third-party and independent candidates. And, of course, these are measures that the two major parties are very, very hopeful will pass and be enacted. Whether it's going to happen or not, we'll see. But, again, the two major parties recognize the threat that can come about because of third-party candidates and independents.
Have there been trends like that in the past, David Stubbin, to stymie third-party opportunists?
Well, it's such a broad question. In other words, the Socialist Party of America, for example, which hit its heyday in the early years of the 20th century, opposed American entry into World War I and kept saying it was a mistake even after Americans entered the war. And so they were really repressed rather violently by vigilante groups, and even the government got into these people are dangerous radicals, they're opposed to the draft. So there's an example of a third-party movement that was sort of crushed by both citizen activism and government effort. In terms of ballot access, Paul is absolutely right. By the way, New York is not an easy state to get on the ballot to begin with, and they're going to make it harder. And one of the things that's driving that is the Democrats are firmly in charge in New York, and New York historically has been a center of left-wing activism. And so the Democratic Party of New York is concerned that they could end up with all sorts of socialist candidates in parties that are to the left of the Democrats, siphoning off substantial shares of the Democratic vote. And the Republican Party has an interest in allowing that to happen because the two parties are not on an even playing field at the moment. And that's one way for New York's Republican Party to get back in the game in terms of electing people to the legislature and at the statewide level.
You know, McCrae Powell, I wanted to ask you what you learned from this experience and if you're running again, and if so, what you would do differently.
So I think one of the biggest lessons we learned is just like what we are capable of as an organization. My campaign was run by an organization out of Athens called Athens Revolutionary Socialists, which also ran Ellie Hamrick's campaign. We know what money to spend was useful. We know how much kind of press we can get for things like this. We had a Dispatch article after all. So those are definitely some good lessons. We kind of know how many more people we can pull through electoral campaigns like this, and what kind of issues people are really resonating with. Like in the area right now, tenants' rights is the big, big issue, and we're hoping to get a tenant union built out of this movement right now.
And McCrae, before I let you go, do you have thoughts about why it seems like more often we see these third-party candidates from different kinds of Socialist Party, Green Party, that kind of thing, running at the national level instead of at the local level? Do you have a thought about that?
I think it's just more attractive to run in, like, you know, national and state campaigns. And it gets you more attention from socialists all over the country that will donate money to you and stuff. And local races, you have to deal with the hostilities of the local already elected officials who probably do not have as many people watching over them that can play dirty politics with you. Can I make one more statement before you let me go?
Okay.
I just want to encourage everyone to organize with your friends, your neighbors, and your coworkers and fight for a better world. Also, Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. Okay. You guys have a great day.
McCray Powell, independent socialist who ran for Nelsonville City Council. He garnered about 7% of the vote. Thanks a lot for joining us. Also, Paul Beck, professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'm always glad to be on, Ann.
And David Stebbin, professor of history and law at Ohio State as well. Thanks
to
you.
You're welcome, Ann. Good to be back.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.